If you ask the best in the world the single greatest secret to success, they'll smile and give a gentle laugh. You're asking the wrong question. Being extraordinary is not a single element. It cannot be distilled down to one thing. We're told that being a success is a magical thing that happens in a place you'll arrive. The hard part is that this long-held truth is the biggest lie. Extraordinary features humans that have reached the top of their field and become extraordinary humans. The door to being extraordinary is now open. Will you walk in? What is up, everybody? Jeremy here. And guys, I am super excited for today's interview. One of the most recognizable professional athletes in the world is Danica Patrick, and she has driven in both the Indy Racing League and NASCAR's Cup Division. She was named to Time's 100 Most Influential People list and has graced the cover of ESPN, the magazine, Sports Illustrated, and TV Guide. She's currently the owner of Somnium Wine, the creator of Warrior Clothing, and in 2017, authored the book Pretty Intense. You can find out more about her over at danicapatrick.com. Welcome to the Create Your Own Life show, Danica Patrick.
Hi.
I'm really stoked to be hanging out with you today, Danica. You've had so many amazing accomplishments and I guess an unconventional way of doing things. So it's really exciting to have you hanging out with me today.
Thank you. Well, yes, I am unconventional, so therefore I do things unconventionally.
So I have to ask you, like, how did racing became the thing that was your passion?
I started racing go-karts when I was 10 years old. And it was really just something that we as a family were going to do on the weekends to spend time together. And it obviously became something much different or much more.
How did you realize it was something you were, like, I guess, that good at to take it to the next level like you did?
Well, I was winning in my first year. That helped. But first, I mean, I was absolutely terrible. I couldn't keep up on the parade laps, which are the slow laps that you get organized and, you know, get information. I couldn't keep up. And, you know, it was terrible to start, but I learned quickly and I was really motivated by, I guess I would always ask my dad if I could go out and practice and during the week. And what I loved about the practice was I remember this part. I loved coming in after a practice run of a few laps or 10 laps or something. And I would say, you know, what was my lap time? And if I would go quicker, it was such a fun, like, instant gratification sort of activity. So, and I just loved that progress, setting goals, achieving them, making progress. And that's really what I loved about racing the entire time. So I got good quickly and then wanted to go to college for engineering so I could learn how to work on my race car. Turns out I don't have to do that. So I moved to England when I was 16 to kind of take it to the next level. But I was able to make a life of it.
And I guess from there, like, how did you manage getting into IndyCar? Because that's, you know, I guess a very particular division and particular type of racing. What drew you to that?
Well, it is, but it is the highest level of open wheel racing in the country. There's Formula One as well. So can't say the world necessarily because there is Formula One and that's also open wheel. The highest form of open wheel racing is IndyCar and stock car racing, it's NASCAR. So on a couple levels. So go-karts is open wheel because literally open wheel just means the wheels are exposed. And then I moved over to England at 16 to continue open wheel racing. And, you know, I'd say at 16 when I left high school my junior year and, you know, got my GED at, you know, a year or so later, that was sort of the point where you're like, man, this goes from something I want to do to something I kind of more feel a little bit like, okay, I better make this work because I just left high school. I have a GED, maybe not the best start to life as far as, going to get a different job, a regular job, something that needs a certification for. So,
well, I think that really shows your commitment to that too, as well, that you're kind of all in, that you know, you could have considered engineering, but you know what, you're like, I'm going to make this racing thing happen. You know, GED is GED and we're just going to do this.
Yeah. Well, moving to England was definitely what showed what would come to be my first real boss here in America, Bobby Rahal, that I was really committed because he's an American. He is, you know, had an IndyCar team. He won the Indy 500. many years ago, and he saw that dedication, and it was part of what, you know, part of what convinced him to give me a job.
What was that experience of racing in the Indy 500 like for you? Because it is one of the biggest races in the world. You know, there's Indy and there's Daytona that are two of the biggest races in the world. What was that experience like for you?
Which one?
Well, I guess just in general, like dealing with a stage that big, like how are you able to perform when the stakes are that high?
Because I knew what I was doing and I had a good car. And I mean, the stakes are high in other ways for other people in their jobs. Like that's just high stakes for me in racing. So I would imagine there are things in your, you know, with your job that are higher stakes and more pressure. And, you know, that's just part of it. It's, that was mine. So, and it's, you know, it wasn't like I just got plopped into the Indy 500 one day. I was, by the time I got there, I had gone through, you know, over a decade, you know, decade and a half of racing. So it was, you know, a transition, not necessarily like an all of a sudden.
For you then, when you made the move into NASCAR, you know, what was your thought process there? And why did you want to try, I guess, your hand at that type of racing?
I just kind of was a little ready. I was ready for a change to some degree. I'm okay with change. Change doesn't really scare me too much. Maybe a little bit right at first, like I was saying the other day. But it's also exciting and it means opportunity and new potential. So I was kind of ready for that. And I was just not having that much fun in IndyCar anymore. I didn't really like that the series had transitioned from almost all oval racing to, vast majority, not almost all, but vast majority road course racing. And, it attracted, more European influence and drivers and whatnot. So it just wasn't something I was having as much fun with anymore. So I was just kind of ready for a change.
Sure. So what's the learning curve in going from an open wheel type car to a stock car like that? Like, what was your learning curve like?
I don't think that the curve ever, like, there's never a stopping point for that. You're always collecting information and, that will drive your reactions based on previous experience. So that never really stops, but, you know, definitely in the beginning it was accelerated and fast. And, I think it was, if the car was right and, you know, I knew what to do, and if it wasn't, then it was harder. Harder to know how the dynamics of the car work to get the most out of it right away. So a lot of times I would go out, the car wouldn't be comfortable. We'd make changes. I'd get more comfortable. And then as I got faster, we'd end up having the setup come back around to like where it started pretty much, or sometimes exactly. And so there's a lot of time wasted just in me kind of figuring out how to drive the car properly, and getting comfortable in the beginning. Just little things like, there's so many little details that you would learn probably at a lower level that you wouldn't have to remind a nationwide driver or a cup driver of, but definitely learned a lot in the nationwide series for the 1 year I was there. But even something simple like realizing that the water temperature was, something I had to keep an eye on, not just before the temperature being too high. Of course, alarms would go off then. But if it was too low, it meant that you could put tape on the grill, which is basically like adding downforce for nothing and would make you go faster, made you go in a straight line faster, made you better in the corners. Like it was just a benefit. And I just didn't even know that in the beginning. You know, I'm sure that I was, sacrificing some performance just based on little things like that, not knowing what to do or what it meant or if to even say anything.
Totally. Well, I had the pleasure of hearing you speak this past Monday, actually, at a Business Insider's Ignition event. And I found one of the things really interesting that you had mentioned is, racing is a very male-dominated sport, but you didn't see what you did as something that you were really doing, because of a male-female thing, but more of to inspire people of all walks of life. Can you tell us a little bit about that and really, what you saw your role in helping others with?
Yeah, but that's not why I started. You don't start out at 10, 11, 12 years old and just because you're like, I want to inspire people. I mean, there are special little beings out there that, are very charitable and whatnot, but not me. I'm not saying I'm not charitable. I'm just saying that I didn't start racing because I wanted to inspire people. I did it because I was good at it and I liked it and I was having fun. So really that portion of it was something that developed over time. And even it took well into my IndyCar, probably into my NASCAR career. You know, late in my IndyCar career, it started coming around. But you have to keep in mind, like, I was 23 when I started racing IndyCars. So, you know, being an inspiration and having, Jesus, I need inspiration. You know, I'm 23. So it wasn't something that really was something I put a lot of thought, effort, or, you know, I didn't put a lot into in the beginning. So, but it became something I felt was really an honor and something very powerful and something meaningful.
So you've spent most of your career, before you've kind of been in the business realm now in a very dangerous sport. For you, how do you manage fear?
By probably just contrasting the thought with hope and what you want to happen. I think that I believe, and this is only thoughts that have become more normal to me as time has gone on in the last sort of 5 or so years. But if you're thinking about what you don't want to go wrong, if you're thinking about how bad something could be, then that's probably more of what you're going to get. If you think about the good side of things, then you're probably going to get more of that. But in simple ways, in the beginning, when I used to do that, it really was just because I just wanted to find reasons to be happy. It's not very happy when you're thinking about fear and misery and concern and, you know, like that doesn't make you feel very good. So I would just, you know, I just always had to combat it with things that made me think good thoughts, being hopeful, and just, you know, being an athlete and in a sport, you realize that confidence is important. I think that's something commonly known and understood within the world of especially sports, like confidence is important. Sometimes you got to fake it.
Absolutely. Well, I had the pleasure of not too long ago interviewing former Green Bay Packer AJ Hawk on the show, and he had said for him, he didn't really have a choice when his career was going to be ending. His body just kind of gave out, and he said, you know, the knees wouldn't let him do it anymore. What was the decision for you to move on from racing? Like, what were you looking at, and what was that decision really like?
Well, first off, I know AJ. He's a really nice guy.
I'm a huge Green Bay Packers fan, so that was a big deal for me.
Yeah. Well, retirement wasn't something that I, you know, especially in racing, I think that's why you see the career so much longer, of course, because you're not dealing with, you know, the level of physical exposure like you are in football and sports like that. It's not a body contact sport. But I think on the other side, if it does become something that affects you physically, I mean, what you see in racing is if you can't race anymore, a lot of times it has to do with something much more serious, like you're paralyzed or you died. I mean, that's, you know, those are the things that happen in racing when it gets so bad that you can't do it anymore based on injury. There's not a lot of things that, you know, last year I sprained my ankle really bad on like a Wednesday, and I was in the car on Friday at Richmond and raced that weekend, which includes braking and everything because it was my left foot. And I had no problem. I mean, the range of motion wasn't so good, but, you know, I could totally race no problem with a sprained ankle, and it wasn't taped up or anything. And then, you know, there are people that have raced with broken, I think Brad Keselowski raced with maybe a broken ankle or something like that. I can't remember what he broke, but he crashed at on a road course and broke something, and he raced and he was fine. I mean, we don't perform our sport is not driven by like physical ending, you know, sort of injuries, like just wear and tear. For us, it's more about motivation, passion. Sponsorship can be a big one for people. So, you know, I was fortunate that in my career, I was able to leave based on feeling like it was time. I mean, the issues with teams or sponsors or anything like that really were, to me, just kind of little nudges in the direction of moving on. Because I really feel like if I wanted to keep going, I could have. It would have just taken more effort, compromise, you know, change of teams, pay cut, things like that. But I just, you know, for me was ready to move on, and the shifting of teams and presumably sponsors and stuff was just all assigned to me.
Totally. And I love the fact that you have a winery that you started in 2009, I believe it was, and it's become one of your big projects. What really made you want to start a winery, and what's running that business been like?
Well, I took a trip to Napa in 2006 for just a fall vacation, and was at a beautiful winery holding a glass of wine at 10 a.m. And, you know, it was so peaceful, and it was everything was like, quiches and fruit out on the table. And I'm thinking, my goodness, this is great for life. And I thought it would be so amazing to have something like this someday. I, at that point in time, thought, man, I can't afford to buy something like this now. Maybe I never will. And I thought that, my dream was to have it though. And so that's why I named the wine Somnium, because it means dream in Latin. And it's because I kind of thought that it might only just be a dream for a while.
I absolutely love that. And one of the biggest things you started last year was the book you put out, Pretty Intense. You know, what motivated you to put out a fitness book, and what was that experience like?
I changed my workouts, and I had, kind of changed my diet and had great results. And so there was interest in, seeing if I wanted to write a health and fitness book. And I was like, man, that's actually really good timing. I did say I would never write a book again, because I did have one come out in, I think, 2006, maybe. And I was like, I'm never going to do that again. But I finally had something to say, something new, something that I felt like would help people. And so I worked really, really, really hard on it. The writer was not getting sort of feel for what I wanted to write about and have the book be about. So I said, either we need to move on, or you need to fly to me to sit down and really experience my life, work out with me, watch me cook. We can talk about all of this, and then we can write the outline and write the sort of, write the basis for the book and the point in the story and the creative direction. And so we did, and we came up with much better direction of what I wanted. And then we sold it to a publishing company. And then after that, I got a very confusing rundown of like mini chapters that just went on and on and on with no real feel or flow or organization. And I was like, this is too much. So I was on an airplane, and I was sitting there, and I wrote the outline for the book of what I wanted it to be, which is exactly what it is. Then for every single chapter, I went into my little notes app, and I wrote as much as I wanted to give a direction for each chapter. Some of them were long, some of them were short. And that gave creative direction for every chapter. And then and then all the chapters would come back to me in sort of more full form. And then I would edit those myself. And then, which they came out pretty much exactly from the edits, plus or minus, I'm sure, some grammatical errors. And then I wrote the workout program. I tested it at a trial group. I wrote the recipes. I photographed the recipes. I feel like it was just like a labor of love, and I'm very proud of it. It was a lot of work went into it, and a lot of heart. And I feel like if someone were to get a hold of it and embrace the program and embrace the messages in it, they would benefit.
I love that when it wasn't doing what you wanted it to do, you really took control of it. And you're like, hey, like, this is where it needs to go. This is what it needs to sound like. And you put the outline and everything together. Because I think sometimes, in life or in business, like when things aren't going the way we want them to, sometimes we can kind of just let it go by the wayside. And the people that really get things done are the one that say, hey, listen, like, this is how we're going to do it. And this is how we can make things happen.
Right. Not only get things done, but get things done in a meaningful, impactful, convincing way. I think that as people, we are very perceptive to what's real and what's not real and what feels authentic and what has a really good message. And, that's what I feel like comes away from people that read the book. They're like, it was really good. It's not a novel, but all of the information is, bullet points and thoughts and, techniques and, You know, there's pages at the end, the first third of the book is mind body. So it's, you know, at the end of each chapter, there's like a little, interactive portion. So some of it is writing down like your, you know, top five places that you want to go to that you can drive, top five places in the country that you want to go and take a trip, top five places in the world, you know, so you can write them down, but more than anything, so that you actually have an answer to that. You want to go on vacation. You're like, dude, I don't know. Well, like, oh, you know, I actually would really love to go to Italy. You know, I mean, it's, you know, because you've actually thought about it. And that's the point, is that if you don't have an answer to what do you want to do, where do you want to go, who do you want to be, how are you ever going to get anywhere meaningful? You're just simply floating through life without real purpose and direction. And that sort of meaningful joy that comes from doing something that you want to do. If you don't do what you want to do, you're going to end up doing something somebody else wants to do.
Very cool. Well, what's something that you believed at 21 that you don't believe now?
Oh, interesting. Probably that, you know, I think there's a little bit of a perspective that, you know, life is, especially a little bit more of a religious direction to it. Like, oh, you know, my life is planned out for me. I'm just on this path and it is what it is. And I'm just along for the ride. And this happened because that's just my life plan. And, you know, you think to yourself, you kind of write off things that don't go well or don't go the way you want or don't feel good because you're just like, well, I guess this is just my lot in life. And I feel like now I'm like, you can create your own reality and your own world and your own emotions and feelings and surroundings. You're in control of that. And so life is what you make it and what you dream of it and what you think of it. It's not necessarily what's just happening to you based on, you know, simply breathing. You have a lot more control of that. And so, and also I think a good growth one too, has just been that the way that somebody talks to you, deals with you, reacts to you is a reflection of them and not you. I think that's a tough one to really grasp, but it's true. If somebody meets you with defensiveness, they're usually trying to hide something, like they didn't try hard enough, work hard enough to do a good job or even to have the right answer. You know, if somebody is in, you know, somebody judges someone else, it's really probably a reflection of their own insecurity about themselves. And so, you know, like, I feel like an example is when you, are talking to somebody, a lot of times I feel like as girls, we judge ourselves so much, and they're like, oh, I don't like this about me. And you'll be looking at them, and you're like, I don't even see that. Like, they literally don't. And so these things, like if someone were to, they're going to take whatever they feel is bad about them or not, doesn't look right about them. And they're going to go, and they're going to see that in everyone else, because that's exactly what they're looking for, because it's already in their mind. And the truth is that, you know, we're just, if we really are in a good place, we're non-judgment, right? We're just accepting and we are understanding and we want to help people, but we don't attack and judge and get defensive and be angry, and because those are all just reflections of something you're dealing with inside. So, you know, those are a couple of things that I feel like as I've gotten older, it helps you have a lot more peace and a lot more patience, and also forces you to look at yourself, because look, I still react to stuff. Of course, I'm a human being and I still have issues and insecurities and paranoias and fears. And like, that's just being a human. But over time I have less and less of them and less reactions, because I've, you know, I accept dealing with them and I accept that they are my reality and they are my problem. And I have to look deeper and peel away the layers as to why I have a reaction or why I don't feel good about something. So that's just kind of the journey of life. And, you know, if you're ready to take it, it's not an easy one, but it's always worth it.
I absolutely love that, because I feel like so many times we take things so personal, we just don't realize that there's other things going on in people's lives. They're fighting their own battles, and sometimes we just have to, you know, look at ourselves and kind of understand, hey, that's their own issue. It's not ours. And I think so many times we just take it personal.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. Well, Danica, just as we're running out of time here, I just have a few more questions for you. And one being, if you had to look at somebody that's world class, what does a world class individual look like to you?
Maybe in like a simple little like anecdotal example would be world-class person would be, how does a world-class person treat a complete stranger that can benefit them in no way?
Yeah, because character is what you're doing when nobody's looking.
Right, exactly. So how do you treat someone that can help you in no way, right? Like, or someone that can barely help you, right? So somebody that you just see in passing, you hold a door for them and let them through, or someone that's cleaning up the tables at the restaurant, or somebody that's, you know, you have no idea who you might meet in passing. Maybe that person you think could be nothing is a CEO of a giant company, but you don't know. So like, how do you treat strangers that are not there to necessarily help you purposefully, like, right? Like, it's not like somebody's walking into a room and they have a business opportunity for you. And of course they're a stranger maybe, but they might be able to, no. How do you treat a stranger in passing? I think that is how you could, simply sort of observe a world-class person is how do they handle that?
For you, how have you sought mentorship in your career? Like, who have you looked to, like, when you didn't quite know what to do?
Whoever is around that is of an expertise in a certain area. I think I've heard that before in like a slightly different capacity. But if you have a foundation, you have a board, like it was explained that the people on the board, if they're outside of the family, if it's a foundation, they should all be people that bring a certain talent or knowledge to the table if they're going to be on a board. I went to a wealth management conference and that's what they said. But I think that for me, I don't really have like specific mentors or role models. I just go to people I trust. So people that, you know, work with me or family, or close friends, people that are completely objective, and I ask for their opinion. And then if there's someone with an area of expertise in what I'm dealing with, I'll ask them.
Absolutely. Well, just as we're coming in for a landing here, Danica, if we could be far in the future, we've looked at everything you've done in your career and everything you created, and we can sum up that legacy with a quote in your tombstone. What does that look like?
Quote on my tombstone, not morbid at all. No, it's fine. I don't care. We're all going to die. Unless we become artificial intelligence robots, and then we won't, but that's for 50 years down the road. it would say, I don't think it really matters. I just think it should be my name and how long I was alive. That's really all that matters. I'm just like, I'll come, I'll go. And some people believe in, afterlife, some don't. So I personally think that, you know, we come back again and believe in reincarnation. So, you know, when we're born, we're just, I mean, it could honestly just say human with the life, because you're born and you don't pick your name. It's not like you own it. You aren't your name. If you remove your name from you, if you remove your eyeballs from you, if you remove your arms from you, are you still you? Yeah, you just are. Not those things. So who cares what's on the tombstone? Who cares what I did? It's over. And you know, the legacy of how you evolve culture and people and consciousness is the legacy part of it. But what's on a tombstone doesn't matter. It just doesn't. It's just, I don't really like flames, but I'd probably want it to be turned to ashes anyway. So it'd be an urn.
Well, Danica, this has been a lot of fun today. For those people out there listening, if they want to connect with you, if they want to learn more, where's the best place to go?
You could go to my social media, which is, I have Instagram and Twitter. It's my name. You can also go to my website, Danica Patrick, which is hosted by, of course, my long-term wonderful sponsor, GoDaddy, which actually today I'm really excited. I'm doing, based on the book, pretty intense. I'm doing an event today, that's a workout program that's to support the workout program. Internally, GoDaddy did what was called GoDaddy Fit. And under GoDaddy Fit, they did the 12-week workout program from my book. And so I was involved and did, you know, live videos with them and talked to them, answered questions. But they did the 12-week program. So there's a group here today that finished the program that I'm going to do a workout with. And so, just in support of, again, all of the things that I love so much. It's like, I can't believe I'm able to go to work wearing not only workout clothes, but my own warrior clothes. And I'm going to work out today, which is something that I love to do, but I'm actually kind of at work. So I love the way that my life has evolved into feeling like it's hard to tell what's work and what's not.
Very cool. Well, Danica, thank you so much for coming on the Create Your Own Life show today.
Yeah, thank you.